Today, we have a very special guest.
There are, you know, huge highs and huge lows. And that's, I think, what we live for.
It's one thing meeting someone on a boat in Cannes or wherever you met him. Yeah. And then you launch a business together and talking about the roller coaster, you're really going to find out who your business partner is. How have you navigated that?
Early on, we knew that one of the top reasons companies fail is because the founders fall out. I think it's like number two or number three.
I would imagine that's 8 times out of 10.
Money, power, prestige.
A young British entrepreneur who has disrupted the world of oral health with the most incredible toothbrush.
We were told by over 20 factories it wasn't possible to make toothbrush heads with these materials, but we'd found some research which had proven it was possible in other areas like phone cases. We also created, you know, a very unique slim build with an aluminium body, and so our product I think really stood out. There's countless billionaires who live in sort of anger or fear or despair or resentment, whatever that is your experience of life, and I think I'm so grateful to do what I'm doing.
He co-founded the brand Suri.
We always thought it could be large, but it's really surpassed even our expectations in the sort of few short years. But at the same time, I think it's actually a fraction of what it's going to be. Like, it really doesn't feel like we've scratched the surface of what's even possible. We raised a pre-seed round before we even had the product. And then we've gone on to raise two other rounds. So in total, we've raised 8.8 million.
Welcome, Mark Rushmore.
I think we've encountered a little bit of everything on that journey. I don't know about you, but like, I learned the most from making mistakes. It was important for us to create an MLP, like a minimum lovable product. And so we did spend a lot of time ensuring that even that first product could be lovable from the outset, because, you know, what our customers, you know, their reactions to it and their score ultimately is the biggest driver of our success. On some levels I feel successful, but on other levels I really don't.
Wow, what a story you have in only 3 years. You started Suri, the most sustainable toothbrush on the planet, and now you have a turnover of 35 million. How on earth have you done that?
Well, firstly, thank you so much for having me on here. It's a real privilege to be part of this. I think what you guys are doing is incredible. So really appreciate the opportunity to share the Suri story.
Thank you.
In terms of the growth, it has been a phenomenal growth journey. I think, you know, we always thought it could be large, but it's really surpassed even our expectations in the sort of few short years. But at the same time, I think it's actually a fraction of what it's going to be. Like, it really doesn't feel like we've scratched the surface of what's even possible. And why is that? Well, how many people do you know who brush their teeth? I mean,
everyone.
And it doesn't matter whether you're 5 or you're 95, you're male, female, or anything else. It doesn't matter what country you're in. You know, it is one of the most common habits, if not the most common habit, of people worldwide. So it's an enormous market. And then what we saw was that within that enormous market in developing countries and developed countries, over 50% of people are using an electric brush. The market's growing double digit year on year. And yet, despite that, there's only two companies who have a roughly 80% market share. So that's extremely unusual. If you think about other things that we all do, like we all wear shoes, right? But there's dozens of shoe companies, none of whom have like a really like totally dominant market share, or, you know, all of us are wearing underwear at this table, but
we hope.
But that's a good point. Not even necessarily. Not everyone's wearing underwear, right?
Very true.
I saw a girl today without one, right? Riding on a bike in front of me.
Well, there you
did
are.
You really?
Wow.
I did.
Wow. So I mean,
did you take a picture?
That's a whole other story.
I'm like, what?
But this is it, and so, you know, even like not everyone washes their hair every day. You know, I thought everyone did, but not everyone.
No,
does.
That's
but
true.
Everyone brushes their teeth. And so, you know, we looked at that and we saw, you know, these two players who have an 80% market share in this fast growing category, which is an absolutely enormous category. And we started doing research and we found that every year over 4 billion brushes are thrown away and end up in landfill and ocean. What's more, virtually every brush that each of us around this table have ever used since we were children probably still exists somewhere because of the materials it's made from. And if you think, you know, through the years, you know, how many toothbrushes that is, and you multiply that by
is
everyone.
That famous sea of plastic
that the
ecologists talk about that's out in the ocean that's enormous.
Well, that's it.
Yeah.
And then when we researched a bit further, you know, when you look at landfills, electronic waste accounts for, I think, less than 2% of the landfill, but it accounts often for over 70% of the toxicity found in landfill. And so there's this enormous problem, you know, close to plastic straws in terms of the impact and the scale that people weren't talking about. So that seemed like, wonder if we could do something about that. But then we also spoke to thousands of people, consumers, dental professionals, and we said, actually, this is normally the point where I like to ask you, I don't know if you use a Surrey, but have you ever used another electric brush before?
Yes.
Okay.
And they're very clunky, actually. Yeah.
Right. And did you ever use a Bluetooth function?
Never.
Never. Of course you didn't. Do you ever have that horrible crust, that gunky stuff on the bottom?
Always.
Always. Absolutely foul.
And in the bit of the connector.
Yeah, and in the bit of the connector. And then, you know, often people told us they wouldn't take them traveling because they're too clunky, they're too loud, you need a special charger. And
yes.
So we started to look at this and think, well, hold on a second, they're wildly unsustainable. People don't necessarily really enjoy using them. The battery dies, they're not using Bluetooth features. So what if we could make a brush that's both more sustainable, but with a better design, with features that people want, like a long-lasting battery, or it's slim, it's quiet, you can USB-C charge it. I wonder what that would do.
There's many people who may look into starting an electric toothbrush. Mm. How did you set about communicating and connecting with sales distributors to get you to where you are today?
I think it all starts with product, first of all. And so anyone can set up a toothbrush company. If you go to alibaba.com, there are dozens of factories. You can order something offline, reskin it and sell it. And there are several companies that do that very successfully. But we didn't want to just take something off the shelf. We wanted to create something unique and bespoke, whether that was using new materials that hadn't been used before. So we use plant-based materials in our head, like cornstarch and castor oil in the bristles. And, you know, we were told by over 20 factories it wasn't possible to make toothbrush heads with these materials. But we'd found some research which had proven it was possible in other areas, like phone cases. We also created, you know, a very unique, slim build with an aluminium body. And so our product, I think, really stood out for having better materiality, you know, a better design, better function. And then from there, how do we make people aware about it? And the answer is we didn't go to distributors initially, but instead we harnessed the power of Shopify and direct-to-consumer advertising. So we started, we filmed some ads, and then we started doing a pre-sale on Facebook and on Instagram saying, you know, we have this idea for this toothbrush, we're going to be manufacturing it, you know, it will be ready in June, would you like to buy it? And what we saw was for every £1 we were putting into Facebook, we were getting £3 back in profit on sales. You want to have a strong return on ad spend, ROAS. And if you're able to get, you know, a stronger ROAS, then you're able to scale how much you spend. So initially you might spend £100. And if you get £300 back, then you can invest £300. Then you'll make £900 back and you can continue scaling.
So you did not go or buy into the whole organic growth movement?
So not initially, no. Like it's very much like D2C and paid advertising was our growth. Or we think about it as like a growth engine because to a certain extent it's within your control. You can sort of, as long as you're being efficient on ad spend, you can dial that up. But then additionally, very early on, we sort of saw that when you're buying a high consideration purchase, like an electric toothbrush, people will search on Google best electric toothbrush, and they will then look to make sure that it's in the reviews. And so someone like The Independent or The Telegraph, they'll come up, you know, top electric brush. And so we were really lucky that we sort of saw this as an opportunity and proactively reached out to the journalists who wrote those reviews. And so early doors, The Independent named us, you know, one of the best new brushes to buy.
Wow.
And that helped with the organic sides.
Well, you've got to have tremendous belief in yourself, actually, and what you're doing. Because if you're describing products that actually factories are saying can't be done, it can't be made, and you're saying no, I've got to do this, this is what has to happen, how do you know there's even a consumer market for that?
I would say that both my partner and I have a background in consumer goods. We work for probably the world's largest consumer goods
Procter & Gamble,
and when you're there, you know, you really look at share data, you look at category data. And so we had a total understanding of the market size by competitor, by price point. We knew the growth year on year for the last 5 years, the projections for the next 5 years. And then what we did was estimate if we could take 10% share of a $3 billion market, what does that look like in terms of distribution, sales? What would our return on ad spend need to be? And kind of had a very detailed plan. And fortunately, to date, we've sort of met or exceeded how we sort of do that.
You met your co-founder by chance, is that right?
It really is, yeah.
Talk me through that and talk me through what you both do differently.
I'm a pretty logical person, but I quite like this idea of fate. You know, you meet someone randomly and you form this connection potentially. And had it not been for the exact things that happened in the preceding 30 years, you might never have made that connection, kind of thing. Yeah. Right. And so at this time, I had another business and I was invited to an event called the Cannes Lions, which is like the Oscars of the advertising industry in Cannes. And while I was there, I had a chance encounter with the chief marketing officer of Unilever, Keith Weed. And he hosts an event for the CEOs of advertising agencies on an island off the coast of Cannes. He said, "Oh, someone just dropped out. Would you like to join, Mark?" And I was like, at the time, I owned an agency and I was like,
let me look at my diary.
27. I was like, yeah, exactly. Like, see if I can. He was like, "Well, if you're free, come down to, I think it was Pier 2, 1:30 p.m. There's going to be a rib. Jump on that rib and, you know, you'll come to the party and, you know, everything's free." So I was like, wow. So, you know, went back to my hotel, got changed, you know, had a shower, whatever. Got there. And then as I jumped onto the rib, there was only four people on the rib, one of whom was Sir Martin Sorrell, the founder of WPP, the world's largest agency group who does all the M&A activity. And I had an agency and I wanted to sell it ultimately to him / WPP. And next to him was this other guy who was about the same age as me. And they were sort of clearly together, working together. And there was also another guy who, he was the CEO of Pearl Fisher, this famous packaging agency. Anyway, I got to the island and I felt like a total imposter. You know, like everyone else was like 20, 30 years older, a titan of industry, you know, had very established businesses.
Clothes were wrong.
The whole thing. And, you know, and but, you know, there's a lot of rosé, so I had a glass. But the only other person who was about my age was this guy chatting to Martin, and we got chatting. And it turned out before he worked for Martin, he'd also worked at Procter & Gamble. I was in sales and strategy roles and based in the UK. He was in finance and marketing roles based in Geneva. So we never crossed paths at P&G, but there was an instant connection. Mm-hmm. And then I was running a business and he said to me right there and then, you know, "I'm doing this amazing job traveling the world with Martin, you know, but one day I really want to set up my own business in consumer goods. And, you know, I've got two beliefs, Mark. Like one, like, you know, the amount of packaging and waste and plastic waste that we saw at P&G. I really think we should do something about that in, you know, in the category like oral care." And also that, you know, he's, my co-founder is like the number one Apple fan. Like he's like almost like an Apple historian. Like we call him Geef Jobs actually. And he loves, you know, the consumer experience, how you open packaging, you know, like the detail, the design. And he's, you know, his hypothesis was that again, in past maybe consumer goods, sometimes, you know, that hadn't moved at the same pace as consumer expectations, which Apple had raised with the way that they did things. So it was like, we could make something that's more sustainable with a better experience. You know, I think we could be onto something.
Did you have a moment of something?
There was just this moment of connection. He also showed me some like really great shortcuts and ways that he could handle high intensity work that he was organizing as the chief of staff and head of business development at WPP. And I thought, wow, this is a guy who can really get stuff done. He knows, you know, marketing and finance. And I love business. Like it's sort of my parents are entrepreneurs and I grew up in this entrepreneurial environment. And I saw in him this same kind of desire that I had. And so, you know, I was like, when we get back to London, you know, let's stay in touch. And we did, and we became sort of friends. This was long before we set up Surrey. I then went on to sell my business. He went on to be the CEO of another venture-backed company. And then after I'd sold and he'd left that, we kind of got back together and he said, "Hey, you remember that idea? Maybe we should do it now."
So you didn't have any investors, am I right in saying?
No, we did.
You did?
Yeah, so we, early on, we sort of saw that we want this to hit it certain scale, and in order to do that at the speed we want, we're going to have capital requirements. Unfortunately, we didn't have much capital between us already, and so we raised a pre-seed round before we even had the product, and then we've gone on to raise two other rounds. So in total, we've raised 8.8 million.
Right. Wow. Did you have any understanding about how difficult it is to get it made, tooling, what country's best, shipping, all of that kind of thing, meeting deadlines and teething problems?
The short answer is no. And it's been a very steep learning curve on the manufacturing side. I think
of course.
We knew a lot about marketing. I knew a lot about running a company and hiring and financing and making profit and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But I think neither of us had like a strong background in manufacturing.
So where is it made now? Yeah. Is it made in China?
It is made in China, in Shenzhen.
Okay.
That's where I think like our estimates are like 95% of electric toothbrushes are made just because the whole supply chain is there.
But it's finding the right factory, isn't it? Obviously, I mean, I've got a good experience of China, and it took us about 3 or 4 factories. I mean, but at one stage, for every hairbrush that I was selling, they were selling one out the back door. So, you know, there's a lot of that going on. So,
yeah, I think a lot of those, like, dare I say, cliches are cliches for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've encountered a little bit of everything on that journey. I don't know about you, but like, I learned the most from making mistakes.
Yes.
And from when things don't go well.
I was listening to an interview that you did that you were saying, look, just launch it and then find out what works, what doesn't work. And what immediately came to my mind is that that can be very costly. You know, at what point do you actually say, do you know what, we've just got to go with this and launch this? Because you can faff around forever trying to get it right.
Actually, someone referred to it on another podcast I heard, which I thought was quite good. It was like, is it a hat? Is it a haircut? Or is it a tattoo? Do you know what I mean? A hat, you can change really quickly, like on, off, test it. A haircut, you know, you have to live with it.
That's a really good analogy, isn't it?
And a tattoo is like, it's going to be forever, or it's going to be painful to remove. And I think when it comes to hardware, it's more like a tattoo. And so actually for us, we, and Guy talks about this, is in software, there's this whole thing around the MVP, the minimum viable product, get it out, iterate it, because you can do that very quickly with software. You cannot do that quickly with hardware. And so it was important for us to create an MLP, like a minimum lovable product. And so we did spend a lot of time ensuring that even that first product could be lovable from the outset, because, you know, what our customers, you know, their reactions to it and their score ultimately is the biggest driver of our success. I'm really glad to say now we have over 15,000 reviews with a 4.7 rating on Trustpilot, which makes us by far the most highly rated.
Would you say, as a person, you operate best when you are actually jumping into the unknown and trying to fix the solution before you hit the ground?
I relish that, and I will embrace it and solve any problem. But you don't want to be in constant firefighting mode. And so I think it's, in a way, that helps you get momentum, like solving problems, getting these things through and maintaining that momentum. But whilst I'm doing it, we're also putting in place systems behind us to ensure that things are more smoothly sailing. The analogy would be like building the plane whilst you're flying.
Yeah, that's an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So many people go through life wanting guarantees, and that's why so many people don't end up entrepreneurs. I mean, where in your background do you think this has come from? You mentioned your parents were entrepreneurs.
My parents came from extremely humble beginnings. My father and my mother decided, actually, we're not going to kind of just follow this trodden path.
We're going to break the mold.
Yeah. And I don't know where that came from for them.
So you would have seen, and grown up with your parents getting more and more successful.
My father had this job, and he left that job, set up a consultancy, and then he was working abroad a lot. So he wasn't home a lot. You know, that's hard on kids and on my mum. Yeah. My mother is a really strong people person and had worked as a volunteer for a marriage counselling company which does it for free, I think, called Relate. And so she built up, you know, this empathy and way to sort of connect and speak to people, but hadn't had a paid job.
That's like Richard, you know. He's a marriage counselor. in many ways, of course.
People tell him anything. Secrets. You wouldn't believe what people tell me.
Well, I could, only because people, you know, I don't know why, but I vividly remember, you know, we could be in a supermarket, in an airport, there'll be someone who's just looking not, you know, quite right. My mom say like, oh, hi, like, are you okay? And then, you know, this person has given me a life story. Yeah. But anyway, my dad said to my mom, I've got this idea for a business. Why don't you help sell, you know, this thing? She's like, well, I've not worked in this business before. I have no idea. It's like, don't worry about anything technical. You know, you're going to phone up these people and just, you know, talk to them. And I think in the first week, my mum made £100,000 of sales. And this company, in the first 4 years, had only made like $5,000 a year or something. And then it went from that to then she got her mum from the school gates to come and help, you know, do some admin. And they took over like the playroom and turned it into a mini office. And then, you know, it just kind of grew and grew and grew. And it was just incredible.
What did that show you?
My parents then did work 7 days a week, 18 hours a day. And when you work with your husband, wife, like there is no off. I remember complaining to them that, you know, we're on holiday or at dinner, or, you know, it's first thing in the morning or whatever. Like, do we have to talk about multilateral wells in Bolivia or wherever? And I didn't understand it or appreciate it. Whereas I think now that I'm also running a business, you know, I have to tell my kids, actually, oh, I'm really sorry. I need to travel this week. And I always thought, like, oh, I wouldn't do that. But here I am.
Well, you turned over in 2025, 35 million in 3 years. This looks like, on paper, an absolute walk in the park. Dream world, you're in utopia. Talk me through the highs and lows, which only we know too well, of being an entrepreneur and starting that up and scaling it up.
You know, quite frankly, you know, a lot of people will be like, oh, wow, you know, how have you got it to that size? But there's so many different factors. And, you know, we've raised money, so we own a portion of the company, whereas there's other people who bootstrapped and own 100% and it's much smaller, but actually, you know, that might be better for them.
What percentage do you own?
I can't share the exact amount because we have a cap table and I don't actually know like how much we're allowed to share, but a significant portion. Yeah. There are, you know, huge highs and huge lows. And that's, I think, what we live for.
It's one thing meeting someone on a boat in Cannes or wherever you met him. Yeah. And then you launch a business together and talking about the roller coaster, you're really going to find out who your business partner is. How have you navigated that?
Early on, we knew that one of the top reasons companies fail is because the founders fall out. I think it's like number two or number three.
I would imagine that's 8 times out of 10.
Money, power, prestige, and the ego goes.
Yeah, I think the number one reason companies fail is they run out of cash. The number two is founders. Co-founders fall out. And so we're very aware of that. And, you know, in the first few months of working together, it was during COVID, we were working on Zoom all day. And so we'd just leave our Zoom on for like 6 to 8 hours a day. And so they'd constantly be there. And I noticed sometimes, like, I would say something and I could see that's kind of rubbed him up the wrong way. And then he might come back at me a little bit harder and just like these little niggles or he'd do something that really make me angry. But, you know, we weren't there to say anything. And so it was kind of these unspoken things were building up, which I think happens in every relationship.
Yeah, of course.
Right.
Of course.
So early on, I said to Guive on a Friday, hey, why don't we take a couple of hours to sort of share with each other, you know, what's annoying each other about our interaction? He was like,
brilliant
nothing.
Idea.
Nothing. He was like, I've got nothing to say to you. And I was like, well, I've got a list. When you did this, I felt that. And he would say to me, oh my goodness, that's not what I meant. I meant this. And I only said it because I was worried about that. And I was like, oh, no way. I thought you were saying it because you thought I was a terrible person or I'm rubbish at my job. I was like, oh, no, it's because I'm worried about this. And when he sort of explained it, I was like, oh, well, okay, that makes sense and I can understand that. And then he was like, well, actually, now that you do say it, Mark.
Yes.
No, actually, there are some things. And what happened was, there was a very difficult conversation to happen. They weren't always, you know, like, oh, instantly solved. But what it meant is like, we sort of aired it out and like, rather than things build up, we just clear them. And it got to the point where I think our communication was almost better than that, than I had with my wife in terms of just like solving issues quickly. We are totally different people. And I think that's both a strength, but also a challenge. 100% I could not do Suri without Guive. I'd like to think you'd say the same, but we have to constantly work on it.
Is Guive more the numbers or you?
I think we're both very, very numerical, to be honest. I think you have to be.
Yeah.
Guive does more on like the product side.
Okay.
And I do more on the commercial side.
Okay.
So whether that's, you know, like working with like retailers, our investors, et cetera. But the reality is Guive's also very heavily involved in that. I'm very heavily involved in product. So.
What is the RRP for Suri?
So our new Suri 2.0 at full price in the UK is £105. And then
that's not a bad price for something like that, I don't think.
What you get as well. So we have a UV light in the case.
I thought you were going to tell me it's about £160-70.
Well,
I mean, look how Dyson disrupted the hair market.
Yeah.
On hair dryers that were like £400. I mean, it's insane what he did. If your product's good enough and you've got the right marketing behind it, people will pay.
Totally. After my family and friends, the thing I love most in life is value. I don't know why. I don't know if it's my Scottish upbringing.
We're exactly the same.
We love value.
That doesn't mean, you know, always get the cheapest thing. It means, are you getting great value from that item? And, you know, it could be really expensive, but if you get a lot of value from it, it's worth it. You know, I dare say your haircuts are probably more expensive than you know, a standard haircut. And yet I know for a fact you have customers who've been coming to you for what, years, decades, because you deliver that value, right?
Yeah, it's more than that. It's an experience, isn't it?
Which is part of the value.
Of course it is. That's exactly it.
If I brush my teeth really, really fast with a regular toothbrush, surely I'm just being the same as an electric toothbrush.
The leading academic research into the efficacy of electric brushes versus manual brushes is called the Cochrane Review. One of the co-authors was Professor Damien Walmsley, who was former scientific advisor to the British Dental Association. And the evidence is totally conclusive that electric brushes are much more effective. So we have ours clinically tested, and it shows that they're up to 5 times more effective than a manual brush.
You don't strike me as someone who's probably changed much over the last 10 years. You seem like an extremely solid individual in person.
Actually, I would say, like, in my last company, I tied a lot of my ego and validation around, like, getting to an exit and making some money. And to the extent that I was so, like, blinkered about, like, the outcome. And again, such a cliche, but, like, you know, it wasn't about the journey for me. It was about the final destination. Got to the final destination. And, like, every cliche, I was like, oh my God, this is not it. This wasn't what it was about. And like, I have missed, you know, 4 or 5 years of my life, like not being as present as I could be, thinking that when I get that, then I'll be happy. And so I think a difference now with this is I realize, you know, the most important asset we all have is time. The quality of your life is the quality of your emotions.
And the quality of your life depends on the quality of your thoughts.
Well, because thoughts create emotions, right? And so there's countless billionaires who live in sort of anger or fear or despair or resentment, whatever. That is your experience of life. And I think I'm so grateful to do what I'm doing.
The key is, well, obviously being grateful, but trying to be present. And had you not had that experience with selling your companies before, unfortunately for me, I still haven't mastered it.
Oh, me neither.
I was up at 3 o'clock this morning thinking about all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, me too.
You know, things that aren't going to happen. I'm not saying it's doom and gloom, but just thinking ahead too much.
Worrying.
I've always, but then on the flip side, I always say that can be a strength, but it's finding that balance.
There's this belief that business is a spiritual game measured in zeros. And this idea that, like, in order to expand, you know, your business, you kind of have to overcome things in your personal character to sort of move beyond certain phases and so on. And I think what you spoke to there, which is also really interesting, I think, is different entrepreneurs use a different fuel to drive them. Yeah. And you can become very successful using a very negative fuel. Mm. Not saying that you're doing that, but like...
adrenaline.
That anger. A lot of the world's most famous and successful entrepreneurs were orphans, right? Or have had some kind of like trauma in their childhood. And it kind of comes back to like, what is success really?
Everybody says it's not about the money, but the only time when they say it is when they've got it.
Totally.
You can't tell 98% of the population that are struggling out there in this country, they can't even pay their rent or their mortgage or whatever. You can't tell them it's not about money. And actually, it's not about money once you've got it, is it?
And I think that's it, you know, like there's definitely more to life. You do want to like provide more for your children and also make, you know, more of a contribution to society and, you know, with more assets, you can potentially do that.
You're obviously in lots of different countries. How many countries are you in at the moment?
So actually we really focus on 2 countries mainly. So UK and the US. Right. We have interest from all around the world. Every week we have a different retailer from Australia or Japan or Germany or wherever. But most of our business is in the UK and US, and the US portion is growing really, really quickly.
When you've got cash flow problems, it's a chicken and egg, because when you have all that interest and you've got all these distributors, I'll never forget going to a trade show in America and everybody's crawling all over me wanting this brush. And actually you're wanting to give it to everybody, but not everybody does the right thing with it. So some of them will buy it for you for the distributor price and then dump it cheap online. Mm. I mean, it's so difficult to know who to give it to. So I think your strategy, and I suppose that comes from Procter & Gamble and knowing who to deal with. I mean, you cut your teeth on that. When I went into it, I didn't have a clue. Right. And I was just so excited. Whoever wants it can have it. Yeah. I remember phoning up. I met, but we nearly lost the whole business on that in America. In America.
Yeah. So
how do you deal with quality control?
Yeah. So we don't use distributors at all.
I'd have known that.
Yeah. The majority of our sales are done, you know,
straight,
direct.
Yeah.
And we also manage our Amazon.
Yeah.
Fortunately, we have some really great retailers who, you know, are very very well known. We're in over 500 Boots stores. They're a fantastic retailer of electric toothbrushes, and we are about to launch in Target across the US. Again, a retailer that we've admired for a long time. I think your distribution strategy is also marketing strategy. In the US, we got picked up by Gwyneth Paltrow and Goop.
What, just by chance?
More or less, yeah. So, we had an inbound phone call because Gwyneth loved the brush and the team wanted to reach out. And then, we went to LA to meet with them, and then happened to come across this store called Erewhon, which is, culturally very significant in America. It's these 10 to 12 stores in LA, but, in Beverly Hills, in Calabasas.
They have beautiful teeth in America.
They do.
But I have to say, yours are very nice.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, as part of the job, you have to kind of, make sure they're good.
He takes them out at night, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Puts them in a glass. He doesn't need his own teeth.
That's you, sweetie.
Well, I'm very fortunate that just by sheer coincidence, my dentist, Dr. Alexandra Day, before I set up the company, she'd been my dentist for a while. And, one day I was telling her, I'm setting up this new company. And then she'd been really helpful on the journey. And it turns out that she is one of the top dentists in the UK. She's a judge on Dentist of the Year. She is just one of the most generous souls, but also phenomenal at her job. Patients talk about her for years afterwards. And actually, she's been really helpful.
There must be a lot of jealousy in the industry that you've disrupted it so much in 3 years with 35 million turnover with something so, so groundbreakingly special. What about the two main electric toothbrush companies? I mean, they can't be very happy with you, can they?
I mean, if they aren't, they haven't said anything to me. For one of them, the former global CEO of Philips Health and Wellness has joined us. So
brilliant.
She ran their Sonicare business for almost a decade and then became the group CEO for health and wellness. And then for another one of our competitors, their former head of dental professional for Europe has also just joined us. And so, I think we truly want to improve the oral health outcomes of people around the world.
I know, with a little bit of background in manufacturing, everybody wants to make everything out of biodegradable stuff and sustainable plastics and reusable plastics. But that doesn't come cheap. So that's what really impresses me, that you've managed to find a price point like that and be as sustainable as you possibly can.
Yeah. No doubt we can make the brush a lot less expensively.
If we use different materials,
have very purposely, chosen to use certain materials that cost more money, are harder to source. But it's so central to our proposition that, it's just not something that we can or would ever compromise on.
There's an awful lot that can go wrong with an electric toothbrush, I would imagine. Yeah. Talk me through that and your returns.
Yeah. So, as with any electronics product, there is, you will have problems like you can drop the brush and the internals will shift and so on. And then also, we're in a category where you're mixing electronics with water. And what we've done, I think, is really try to communicate really quickly with anyone who has had an issue and try and find a solution on a human level.
It's finding the right factory and the right partner, isn't it?
Finding the right factory and the right partner.
Did you meet your wife before you were successful or after?
Well, I think that presupposes that I am successful. I'm not sure that I would consider myself successful yet.
No, you're successful.
Do you know why you don't? Because you're living in the present. That's why.
But I think, for me, being successful is trying to be the best husband, the best father, and to enjoy myself a little bit. And so I don't know. It's funny. It's a funny question. On some levels, I'll feel successful, but on other levels, I really don't. And actually, this is another interesting thing that I learned, which was everyone has rules for how they want to feel certain things. And so, for example, I want to feel successful. My rule for being successful is I need to do this and this and this and this and this. So I've got five conditions. If one of them isn't being met, I don't feel successful, right? Now, the easy way to change that is to not have so many rules, or to say, I'm successful if I'm friendly, or if I wake up, or if I go on a podcast, or you know what I mean? And then you find yourself with more ways to feel successful. But I don't know, what needs to be true for you to feel successful?
I have this thing.
What needs to be true?
Every single morning as I wake up, I make a decision. to have a fabulous day, to be a fabulous woman, and to eke out and be my most fabulous self I possibly can be to myself and others.
Well, you weren't like that to me this morning.
No, yeah, I wasn't. I'm very sorry about
that. But what needs to be true to be like for you to feel fabulous?
I realised a number of years ago that happiness is a decision, not a choice, it's a decision, and it's a daily decision. And so once I nailed that and I realized, and I'd sort of made peace with my past, I'd learned how to exist in the present, but I feel very complete now, and I'm at peace with everything.
Do you think that has anything to do with being with me?
Actually, everything to do with being with him. He's taught me a hell of a lot.
Yeah, on balance, I think it is about being happy. Roz, she helps me enormously, and you know, she'll just call me up and say, look, can't you, you know, let's just make a gratitude list here. But, you know, yeah. she really means it. She can say, look, it's a beautiful day outside.
Totally.
You know.
Like for me, I think I'm still on this journey where even though I know this as a sort of intellectual concept, you know, I still have these inbuilt rules, which, yeah, you know.
It's a work in progress, isn't it?
It's a work in progress.
Of course it is.
And it also gives me some of my strength as well. So then you're like, oh, do I want to let it go?
Have you heard of, what is it, Mo Gaudat? Where he has his principle. Yeah. I love him.
Well, he's insane, isn't he?
Yeah. You should get him on.
Oh, God, we'd love him
I will
on.
Ask him.
We would love him
He
on.
Has this principle where he's nailed down acceptance. So acceptance is the core of happiness, basically. It precedes happiness. He's nailed down acceptance to
8 seconds. He will let something. Recent. Yeah, that's what I heard him say.
I mean, I think I'm probably more like 12 seconds. No, I'm kidding.
I think I'm more like 12 days.
But this is it. And like, I think actually, like, part of this business and growing this business has been learning to deal with like very difficult news or challenging situations more quickly. And I think at the start, you know, something would bother me for weeks. And slowly but surely, depending on the severity, I almost think about it like in A&E, you wouldn't want to come in and your doctor to like be panicking. Do you know what I mean? Like with the severity of the situation.
It's a very good analogy.
You're much more likely to deal with the situation in the moment if you can try and keep sort of relatively level head, like let it affect you, then put that aside and be professional, get on with it.
That's great.
Because you're not going to help the person in front of you if you're, you know, super emotional either way about it. And so do I achieve that? You know, ask my team. Definitely not. Like, I'm getting better at it.
Yes, but the fact that you're aware of it and that you know that you're a work in progress and you have worked out at 40 years old what you need to do the best you can to be happy. What does your exit look like? Or are you not even thinking about an exit?
You know, we don't really think about an exit. Instead, we're just so committed to continue building a product that people love. So, you know, this 4.7 with 15,000 reviews, you know, I want to get it to a 5 with 2 million reviews. You know, I think the product that we're building is truly, you know, in terms of performance, design and sustainability, you know, really leading the field and making a difference to people's oral health, you know, to the impact that we have on the planet. Mm. We're on this long-term journey to truly deliver that at scale.
Well, that's just very inspiring.
You're on death row.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yeah. Now, Mark, I'm the prison guard. Mark, what would you like for your last meal? Because it's time.
It'd have to be like a 21 course tasting menu to extend probably the time that I'm alive.
That's a brilliant answer.
And just be like, well, you know.
I thought you were going to say, well, I don't know. I'm going to have to think about how I'm going to clean my teeth afterwards.
Well, probably wouldn't be too worried at that point, but well.
Probably the best answer we've had. Mark Rushmore, you have been an absolute joy. We have loved this, haven't we? Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lovely. And I can and see you clearly as a billionaire, and I was thinking, my God, that's a man I didn't hear.
I was going to ask, can you lend me a fiver?
I think probably the other way around, to be honest.
Thanks for coming on.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Can you do us a favour? Can you hit that follow and subscribe button? You can find us anywhere where you get your podcasts on Entrepreneurs Worldwide. And there'll be a new episode every Wednesday at 5 a.m.